Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 16th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Charlie Mays with a Bible study entitled, Who Then is the Faithful and Why is a Slave? The session number is 99-9. Let's listen in.
All right, what leaps out at you here?
There seems to be a sense of sin as disturbing the future in terms of a generation.
How so?
Well, up above where it said the people who murdered the prophets, by identifying that you were related to them, you kind of, it's like you assume some responsibility for it. And then down below where it says, I tell you, all this will come upon this generation, the murder of Hezekiah.
Okay. All right, we'll look at that phrase, come upon this generation, because it gets real problematic in chapter 24. So I want to set that back a little bit for our discussion. Anything else anybody sees here? I mean, it raises interesting questions, obviously.
Well, it continues the whole righteous discussion, this looking righteous, supposedly.
Okay. So who exceeds, I mean, we got to have any righteousness that exceeds this. Okay.
It isn't the show, it's the inside.
Okay. One of the interesting things about this, obviously, again, I think we need to understand that Jesus, being a Middle Eastern person, because I think it's still true to this day, was given to hyperbole. I mean, he loved to, I mean, he's addressing these people and calling them rotten tombs and dirty cups and all that. I mean, he's, you know, really pushes that imagery out. And then he gets to this last part. And notice the last woe is the longest, but it is also perhaps the most contemporary. We now have Martin Luther King Day. And I remember when I was a young pastor that J. Edgar Hoover thought he was a communist. And I remember one time we were having a Reformation service in the National Cathedral, I can't remember, I'll have to ask John. The black Methodist pastor from Washington, D.C. told us, who were planning the Reformation service, which we held in the National Cathedral, that either he could come and speak or they'd picket our Reformation service. Because he wanted to talk to us about reparations. And so we decided it would probably be slightly less disruptive to let him speak than to have him picket the place. So we start out and we're having a normal Lutheran service, and we have the brief order for confession and forgiveness and everything. And then this black pastor got up there and gave us what for. And one lay person, I hope he's a lay person, but stands up he was in the Great Crossing, sitting pretty much in the front. He stood up and he says, I've already confessed my sins, I don't need to hear this stuff, and he left. So Martin Luther King was a troubler of his time, and now we honor him. And Martin Luther was a troubler of the church, and now we honor him, but don't change anything. Huh? And isn't that what Matthew is recording Jesus is saying? You guys are saying, boy, if I had been alive in Martin Luther's time, I'd have joined up in the Reformation. Or if I'd been alive, I'd have been right in there marching in Selma and all that kind of, well, maybe not. I mean, that's what Jesus is saying about, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. Ernst Käsemann has a wonderful thing in his book, Jesus Means Freedom, about all of this, about how we now honor the troublers of the church and society who are long dead, but don't disturb anything now. Okay, we don't need to say much more, I think. We will come back to this thing about this generation, and also, again, I think you see how horrendously misunderstood this can be and how tragic it can be if we say, so that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth. And if you read the scribes and Pharisees as the Jewish people, then you can put them in the gas chamber because they're just getting what Jesus said they would get. So this is very dangerous to you. I mean, to read this stuff as if it's not a warning to us, but rather is a cause of the tragedies that Jewish people have experienced in history, and that's the way it's been read a lot. Okay, how many of us grew up? You know, I grew up having been taught that the reason that black folks were slaves was because of the curse of Ham. You know, never mind that, you know, that other races have been enslaved also, but that was a very common understanding and used throughout in the history of the church in America about slavery. Okay. Verses 37 through 39, would someone please read that?
O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often have I longed to gather your children together, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.
Okay, what do you wonder about in this little passage?
It's a very feminine view.
Okay.
Compassion.
Okay. Jesus wanting to gather Jerusalem. How often is kind of interesting because this is the first time that we've seen Jesus in Jerusalem in this gospel, but that's not anything to worry about. I think this passage is another one of those places where Matthew is trying to help his church understand history. Because I accept a late view of Matthew's authorship, namely sometime after the year 70, in which the city of Jerusalem would have been destroyed. And this provides some explanation as to why that destruction took place. Again, this has dangerous implications and also gets us off the hook, because I think we need to ask ourselves, if we're chicks running around here, are we willing to be gathered under Jesus' wings? And so again, I think it's a sense in which we need to read this from the inside rather than just seeing it as I think it was in the first place, a sense that if we're going to explain how Jerusalem fell, especially in the light of so many clear Old Testament passages which anticipated that when God established God's rule on earth, the temple and Jerusalem would be exalted. Just go back and read Isaiah 60 and following and see how clear it is that when God establishes God's rule, Jerusalem and Israel are going to be exalted. And now Matthew is claiming that Messiah has come, the rule of God has been established, and Jerusalem is in ruins. How do you explain it? Now, Luke is far more interested and far more deliberate in answering that question than any of the other Gospels. He talks more about the temple. He talks more about Jerusalem. In fact, twice he has Jesus weeping over Jerusalem or lamenting over Jerusalem. And so he's telling us if we'd only listen to Jesus, we'd know why Jerusalem was in ruins. And for us, if we don't listen to Jesus, we'll know why we're in ruins. Okay? That's just a quick, dirty, not nuanced kind of comparison. Let's read chapter 24, the first 14 verses. Well, wait one thing before we go to that. I need to call to your attention, who was the audience in chapter 23? I purposely saved that till we were done. Who's the audience?
The crowds and disciples.
The crowds and disciples. The reason I wanted, this is another little teaching device. It's always important to notice in the gospel stories the geography and the audience. Remember, we met the crowd in Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, and now the crowd is here again when he talks about these woes. And we're going to meet the crowd a little bit later because we're going to try to figure out, is it the same crowd at the cross that was the crowd at the triumphal entry? Or did they haul in another crowd? Okay, so I just want to notice that. We'll get to that on Friday. All right. Verses 1 through 14 of chapter 24.
As Jesus came out of the temple and was going away, his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. Then he asked them, "You see all these? Do you not? Truly I tell you, no one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." When he was sitting on the mountain of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Jesus answered them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Messiah,' and they will lead them many astray. And you will hear of wars, rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these at the beginning of the birth pains. Then they will hand you over to the torture and will put you to death. And you will be hated by all nations because of my name. Then many will fall away and they will betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because of the increase of the lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world as testimony to the nations, and then the end will come."
Okay, thank you. Again, what came to our minds?
I just see people who are pretty fundamentalists that I'm in contact with just always citing these things to me as examples that, watch out.
Yeah, me too. There's the signs that the end is coming, mm-hmm. and that... that is, we are seeing all these things happening, and thus they want to see what the end of the day is going to look like, and when is Jesus coming. But I was wondering if this has some connections with the state of affairs in their own class, because they're without means, and therefore it's very unsettled. I was wondering.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's so much about class, but in G.B. Caird's The Revelation of St. John the Divine, his commentary, I think it's like on page 79, I've quoted it so many times, he's got a whole delineation of the historical events that would have happened by the time, in his case, the book of Revelation is written, but also by the time the book of Matthew is written. Vesuvius erupted in 79, made Mount St. Helens look like a candlestick. You'd had several famines in the Roman Empire. After the death of Nero, there was a civil war in Rome because there were four people that wanted to be the emperor. And there'd been an invasion from the eastern part of the empire by the Visigoths. So all of these things, they were reading them in the Jerusalem Post. And you could go to pick your day, pick your century, pick your time, and see if these headlines don't still fit. So it isn't in the particularity, and as we're going to see when we get over, I have the perfect Bible verse for your fundamentalist friends. The absolute perfect one for them, or Matthew has, when we get to verse 36, but we'll get there. And then there's all this kind of stuff. This one kind of thing is kind of looks like the world is falling apart. And the other one, it looks like human relations are falling apart. And it also reads a little bit like some of the events in the book of Acts, the second part, the human events part, right? Now, here's the interesting thing. There is a theme. I was really helpful at the last session because Dan Spencer was here with his weaving. And so you could use the illustration, there is a thread that's being woven. And here it begins. Remember, the disciples come. Jesus is sitting on the Mount of Olives, so he's looking over all of this stuff. The disciples come and they ask him privately. This is a word now for the church. The crowds aren't there. This is for the church. Verse 6. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed. Then move over to verse 12. And because of the increase of lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And I think there's a real connection between verse 12 and 13. And we live in a time with the perceived increase of lawlessness makes everybody more circumspect, more self-centered. You know, statistically, the crime rate in the United States is going down significantly. But is that the perception of anyone? And what happens? I like to use this as an illustration. The house that we lived in Minneapolis, the finest house I'll ever live in. I absolutely love that house. But on the front porch and the front windows were wrought iron bars. Because we were kind of in an area when getting over to Mary's neighborhood. But, you know, and I often wondered about those bars, whether they kept others out or kept me in. But for me, it's a wonderful parable about what happens with the increase of lawlessness. In the middle of December, I went to Los Angeles for a brief time. And I remember writing, it was a very strange story, which I'd love to tell you sometime. I was on the Lisa show, But I went down, they picked me up in this stretched limousine, and we're driving from the airport to Hollywood, and all these wonderful mansions, and if they don't have a fence around the outside at the sidewalk, they've got gates up at the porch. I mean, these where they've got their Mercedes and Lexus SUVs and all that stuff, and I just thought, how long can this go on? The increase of lawlessness and this whole thing about your love, don't let your love grow cold. Boy, is that a word for us or what? And the Y2K thing and about, boy, you better get your... What this passage would tell us, I think, and when we get to the end of chapter 25 is, why don't you go out and buy all the survival stuff you need and give it to your neighbors? Mm-hmm. Because you see, one of the things about do not grow alarmed, do not let your love grow cold, endure to the end. And then when we get to chapter 25, we have the whole clue to the whole thing. I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty. I mean, this is how we survive in the midst of the chaos that marks the end of things. Okay, let's move on quickly because I do want to get to... the good and faithful servant. Would someone please read for us verses 15 through 31?
So when you see the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place, as was spoken of the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one on the housetop must not go down to take what is in his house. The one in the field must not turn back to get a coat. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For at that time there will be great suffering, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no one would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and produce great signs and omens to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Take note, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the suffering of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the earth, heaven to the other.
Okay, and would you mind to read the next through verse 34 or 35? That would, I should have just stopped there instead of where I did.
From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away.
Okay.
Sounds like Revelation.
It does. And in one sense, I think this has exactly the same purpose as the book of Revelation,
yeah,
which is pastoral. It's not predictive.
Yeah.
Okay? But what else do we see here? What else? Once we point this out, I think it's quite obvious, but...
Prepare and be ready.
Okay, prepare and be ready. That's a theme we're going to get into increasingly in the, as we move into this material. Okay, what else?
We don't really know when the Son of Man will come.
Yeah, we don't really know. I love the let the reader understand. That lets me off the hook. But the other thing I think this is saying is when all this happens, it's going to be so darn obvious you can't miss it. It's going to be like... vultures flying over, they know where the dead corpse is. They're going to be there, and when the Son of Man comes, man, nobody's going to miss the show. So the obvious conclusion then is what?
Just go about.
Okay, it hasn't happened yet. So then the question is, how do we live in the meantime? So.
Seems to me that we live somewhat in a schizophrenia because we're praying, come Lord Jesus, and here we're going, but not right now. But there's this kind of, you know, we really look forward to that, and yet we have some fear about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why will the tribes mourn?
Well, you see, one of the things that, I'd like to think, I mean, this... I'm going to impose my theology on Matthew now for a moment and be real clear about it. Sometimes I try to be more subtle, but at this point, Matthew, it seems to me, is driving. At this point, Matthew is being a good Southern Baptist preacher trying to preach for decision. And so he puts the options as starkly as possible. The good folk, in fact, he's talked about this before, especially like Verse 31 is reminiscent of the parable of the wheat and the weeds. When the weeds grow up and the hired men want to go out and pull up the weeds, and the master says, no, wait till the end time, and then we'll gather them all together. And so that theme comes back here. But there's going to be division. So unless you want to fry in hell, you better get on the train. Now, I think that, I mean, my theology comes in that point, is that I'm offended by that, by all these images of destruction. And so I'd like to excuse Matthew by saying he was preaching for decision, and that was the device he used. But he's obviously using the device of separation. And he makes the images as grotesque and tragic as possible. And so the other thing, another way one could say this is that there's a whole lot at stake here. But here's the point that gets so surprising. If I want to save my own skin, what do I need to do? I need not to be concerned about saving my own skin. I need to be concerned about feeding the neighbor, giving the thirsty a drink, clothing the naked. That's where we're coming. That's where we're going in this text. It's very interesting stuff, I think. And then there's this other problem in verse 34. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place, and they obviously did not. So the conclusion has to be either Jesus blew it. I mean, this has been a problem to the church from the very beginning. Did Jesus simply not understand? I mean, did he miss the point? Albert Schweitzer says what happened to him was that he laid his shoulder to the wheel of history, and it turned and crushed him. That's in Search for the Historical Jesus. Wonderful image. But so, and then, you know, others have said, well, you know, maybe Matthew misunderstood or whatever, but like someone pointed out in this morning's Bible study, Matthew wrote this when most of that generation had already died. So I don't know what that means, except that, but then I do think, and again, whether these are the words of Jesus or the words of Matthew when we get to verse 36, I mean, it really sounds strange that Jesus says with great definitiveness, all this is going to happen before this generation passes away. And then in the next verse he says, well, only God knows. Right? I mean, this is interesting stuff. What it means, I don't know. But I do know, I mean, the one thing I know about this stuff, it seems to me, is very clear, is this thread. Don't be alarmed. Don't let your love grow cold. Endure to the end. And then keep watch, and we know how to keep watch because that's tomorrow's Bible study. Is how it is you keep watch and you keep ready and all of that. All right, let's read verses 36 through the end of the chapter.
But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together. One will be taken, one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this. If the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. Who then is the faithful and wise slave whom his master has put in charge of his household, to give the other slaves their allowance of food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master will find at work when he arrives. Truly I tell you, he will put that one in charge of all his possessions. But if that wicked slave says to himself, my master is delayed, and he begins to beat his fellow slaves and eats and drinks with drunkards. The master day when he does not expect him, and at an hour that he does not know, he will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Jesus, meek and mild. Okay, comments?
It doesn't say like when one will be taken and one will be left. It doesn't evaluate at all why. It just keeps repeating that.
Okay, now I think that goes back to the parable of the wheat and the weeds. You know, we think we know. But that's why Jesus keeps the hired men, the clergy, out of the field. Out of that part. They can harvest, maybe, but they're not. I mean, he doesn't like them weeding. That's not good. It's not good. Okay?
It says a lot about judgment.
Yeah. What?
It says a lot about us judging.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Luther supposedly said that if he were God, he could fill hell up in a minute. So he realized that probably wouldn't be good to leave him in charge of that, I suppose. But let's just look at this real quickly, because we're running out of some time, and I just mean this to be suggestive and provocative, and then we'll have a chance to talk about this some more tomorrow. First of all, again, this thing that ought to have caused Hal Lindsey and others a great pause is verse 36. And this whole anxiety about how the end is coming, it's much easier in one sense to be worried about a roadmap to the end than it is to be about what we're called to be about. I remember when the Gulf War was going on and everybody thought, well, this is Armageddon. We got the geography for it. I went down to our local Bible bookstore and asked them if I could have their best-selling book. And I can't remember the name of it now, except it had something to do with oil in the mid, it was Dyer, somebody wrote it. And he had the whole scenario about how the Gulf War and all that was going to be the end of the world. You can buy the book at discount now. But you see, this text says, why bother with that? This text is so utterly clear about, and I think, again, Matthew's trying to get us to ask some questions. And so verse 42, keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. 44, therefore you must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. So the question ought to be, a sixth grader could ask it, how do I get ready? What does it mean to be ready? And the chapter 25 is going to answer the question. It's going to be so easy, it's scary. And we don't want to do it. But that's, you know, it isn't building bomb shelters. That's not getting ready. And then you see, comes the question that I propose shaped the whole these chapters is, who then is the faithful and wise slave? And the word wise could be just as easily translated shrewd or thoughtful. It's the same word when you go back to the end of the first long teaching discourse in chapter 7. The wise person built their house on the rock, the Petros. But it's the same word for wise, shrewd, thoughtful. And so who then is this person that really knows what's going on? And notice again, a little hint here. Whom his master has put in charge of his household to give the other slaves their allowance of food at the proper time. Provisioning the neighbor again. Now here's something again, lest we think all of this is a zero-sum game, because this could be read this way. Blessed is the slave whom his master will find at work when he arrives. Truly, I tell you, he will put that one in charge of all his possessions. Well, if it's a zero-sum game, I'm going to be the only one with all the possessions, folks. Sorry about the rest of you. So obviously, again, this is a case of hyperbole. Jesus isn't intended to be taken literally at this point, that only one slave is going to be put in charge of everything. And so in order to prevent being cut in pieces and thrown in with the hypocrites, can you imagine a hell more awful than being with hypocrites? Folks like us. But and then there's going to be the weeping and gnashing of teeth. So how do we avoid that situation? Well, now, chapter 25, we're going to find out. And we're going to see the themes of keep awake, be ready, use the talents that you've been given, and then 25, 31 and following. So clear to me. And it goes right back to the theme about what is the righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, and it is the concern for the other. Okay? All right. And again, you know, when I get to heaven and we're drinking the good Wittenberg beer with Luther and Matthew's going to say, huh? Okay, thank you and have a good day.